ABC AFL Daily is the best conversation in footy. Hosted by Corbin Middlemass and Ben Cameron, alongside regulars like Mick Malthouse.
I mean, I don't remember too many games, but it's one of the ones I remembered. It was just that physical.
Bob Murphy.
Where do you guys get off thinking you can pick and choose?
And more, it keeps you in the loop with the biggest stories in the AFL and the number one analysis in the game. ABC AFL Daily, 5 eps a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Here is Salajeta. Oh,
big
great save.
Save
again by Schwarzer.
It's a huge save.
Wonderful save.
It's the sort of heart that you need to make World Cups. Mark Schwarzer, you are a champion.
If anyone knows how to save a penalty, it's Mark Schwarzer. And as Australia readies for its World Cup knockout clash with Egypt, shootouts are very much in play. I mean, Germany just got sent packing by Paraguay in that manner. Morocco dusted the Dutch on pens. Well, today our most decorated keeper is telling us the art of saving penalties. We also asked him about the Australian camp. Have you noticed that one of our brighter stars, Nestori Iancunda, has done very little media during this tournament? Have you noticed Tony Popovich has been bristling a bit when he's asked about his selections? Mark is going to give us some context, not to mention his recollections of an alleged match-fixing incident from the last time Australia played Egypt. Yeah, we covered some territory today. I'm Patrick Stack. This is ABC Sport Daily World Cup Special. Mark Schwarzer is a Socceroos legend here to preview Australia's round of 32 clash between Australia and Egypt. Schwartz, really good to see you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I had a couple of days off and got a couple more days off before my next game, so I'm looking forward to it.
Good to see that you're well-rested coming into the pointy end of the tournament. Coming into this game in just a second, but I just want to actually start with the last time we played this nation. You were part of an Australian side in 2010 that lost 3-0 to Egypt in Cairo. And what I didn't appreciate until I sort of started reading up on that fixture was that game actually concluded under a cloud of suspicion. In fact, a convicted match fixer wrote a 2014 book claiming to have rigged the game using the referee in the process. It's been written up in the Sydney Morning Herald midweek here in Australia. What do you remember about that game, Mark?
I remember it being like there was definitely a very, very suspect decision made in terms of a penalty awarded right late in the game.
Which is hardly conclusive.
Goodness me.
The referee had a great view. Whatever he thought he saw, he had an unimpeded view of it.
I've seen more push and shove in the playground, but it doesn't matter because Mohamed Zidane has wrapped it up for Egypt.
I remember that, and I remember being really, really annoyed after the game, feeling like we weren't just playing against Egypt on this day. It felt like we were just there as a number for a reason. A game that, yeah, it was disappointing the way in which it was played out and the way it ended.
What's that feeling like as a player? Like, what are you guys saying to each other in the rooms afterwards? It must be, and you've travelled all the way to Cairo to play Egypt. It must be an odd feeling.
Yeah, and it's a friendly, right? So people kind of almost like just brush it under the carpet because it's a friendly, it's no biggie. All right, it's a friendly, you lost 3-0, all right. But like for us, every game was really massive for us and we were excited about playing in Egypt and hadn't played there before against, in a country that they're football mad. The atmosphere was really, really good and you were excited about the game, but then not really felt like you were given much of a chance. And that's the difficulty of it. Yeah, it wasn't our best performance, but also some of the decision-making was very, very dubious.
A late penalty ultimately ensuring that 3-0 victory. Let's talk a little bit about penalties because we're in the stage of the World Cup tournament where shootouts are very much in play. Not many people better to answer this question. How does one save a penalty under extremely high stakes, high pressure?
Well, the pressure element you kind of put to one side. You have to find that zone period, that zone area. You have to get in the zone. You do your thing. You focus on the job at hand. Today's enormous amount of information on the opponents are there in abundance. And like leading up to this game against Egypt, I'm sure all the goalkeepers would have been really focused on Egypt's penalty takers, who are the regular penalty takers, who are, you know, all the players that potentially could take a penalty in the penalty shootout, and then having a lot of research into types of penalties, directions they more often go. There are often little indicators in direction of people's taking the penalties. Sometimes it's a particular movement in their run. It might only be the slightest movement, but if you've seen enough of their videos of their penalty taking, you can pick a pattern. And sometimes that's a little bit more obvious than others. Sometimes the decision making is left to the very last second and split second. So sometimes most of the time it's very difficult. I'm always have been a fan of staying really fit as long as possible. And we've seen it quite a bit already in this tournament where we've had two penalty shootouts. Quite a few of the players have stuttered their run, paused at moments of time, and then waited for the goalkeeper, trying to entice the goalkeeper to make the first move. And what we've seen more often than not is that the goalkeeper hasn't moved earlier. And then the taker has been put under an enormous amount of pressure because it's almost like there's a bit of a panic.
Private. Bottom of the post.
Oh, it's the hit. She gets his eyes up. He tries to read which way the goalkeeper's going to go. It was a stutter step.
They either put the ball further wider of the goal. We've seen people miss the goal, but we've also seen people put it too close to the goalkeeper. We've seen also some really good saves.
Some of them starts his run up and he's saved.
There is an element of, I believe, putting the pressure back on the kicker even more. So stay on your feet as long as possible. Don't give him an inkling of which way you're going to go. Wait for the penalty to be taken. Look, if it's a really good penalty, you've got zero chance. But in this instance, I feel like you are giving yourself a best opportunity to put off the taker and to give you a better chance of making a save.
You talk about the stutter step, and we saw in the Champions League final, that was a real talking point. I feel like it's in vogue from a player's standpoint, because I feel like we're seeing more of it. From a fan standpoint, it is like such a headache when you're watching your team and your player start a step. As a keeper, do you kind of love it? Is it a tell? Is that what you're talking about? It's an indicator?
It's an indicator that they want you to go first. It's not a necessary indicator of which way they're going to go, but that also is part of all the information you have. So as an example, Harry Kane the other day for England, he did a stutter step.
Livakovic in the Croatian goal. Kane, the little stutter, and it's saved.
I felt like he was trying to force the goalkeeper to move. He didn't. And then he was caught in two minds, or he didn't have enough time and space to readjust to put the ball further enough in the corner. We've seen that a number of times. So that element of it is the bit that's intriguing. And when you've researched all these players, sometimes they will take more of a stutter than others, like in Harry Kane's instance. And I'm sure the research will probably show you when he does one, it goes one way, and he does the other, it does another way. And it's actually kind of more often than not, the player themselves don't even know they're doing it.
I remember you having a tremendous shootout against Canada. Of course, we all remember the Uruguay one as well.
Rodriguez against Mark Schwarzer. Saved by Schwarzer!
Great
He's
save!
He's done it again!
And I just wanted to know, what is it like in the moment as a keeper when you're just on an absolute heater in a shootout like the Uruguay situation in 2005?
Yeah, because those two experiences were also very, very different. So like in 93, you know, I was 21 years old, right? So there was zero pressure on me, really, and expectation of me to make any saves. And obviously I saved two penalties on that day against Canada and we progressed to the next stage of qualification. And then fast forward 2005 against Uruguay. What for me was there was extra fire in my belly because I noticed that there was going to be a potential substitution made and that I was going to come off. So I was like, last couple of minutes of the game, already like going through my head, oh my God, I can't believe this is going to happen. Like, this is devastating. Like, I just can't believe it. And then the other part of my head was going, just forget about it. You just got to do your job. Obviously, it didn't happen because Brett Emerton got injured or got cramps and had to come off. So I was kind of like, I was a bit angry about it. Like, it was weird. Like, I kind of used that as extra kind of fire if I needed any, an extra motivation to prove that would have been a bad mistake. And again, I did the same thing about stay on my feet as long as possible. Because in those days, we didn't have as much information on players. You didn't have that research. You didn't have all that information about how many penalties people took, how many players took penalties. I actually went into that penalty shootout hardly knowing any of those players. I didn't know any of the players, what they were going to do or where they were going to go.
Tell me about the dark arts that keepers might employ against each other, against other penalty takers, things you can do as a keeper to get an advantage.
The rules are tightened up a little bit more. So you used to waste more time. You used to come off your line. You used to try and get the penalty taker to replace it. You're complaining to the referee, the ball's not on the spot. You take your time because the longer they're standing there and when they're ready to take the penalty, the hope is that they're going to feel that pressure a little bit more. They're going to be taken out of their focus is slightly taken away from it. Today's a little bit more difficult because referees are right onto it after the last World Cup in Qatar. I think the biggest dark arts we see today is that players have these sheets with all these information, whether it's a bottle, whether it's in a towel, whatever it is. And we see how the goalkeeper's seeing it and then picking it up and throwing it away, hiding it. So we see that sort of stuff happening more and more. Whether that's going to happen in this World Cup or not, I don't know. But I've seen that over the years quite frequently. But for me, it wasn't about that. It was more about trying to stay on my feet as long as possible, take as long as possible, delay them, put them out of their stride somehow.
Who's our best chance if we go to penalties who's our best keeper in a penalty scenario against the three that we've got? Izzo, Matty Ryan, and of course, Patrick Beech.
You know what? Statistically, I don't even know. I haven't seen enough of penalties. I know Matty Ryan not so long ago made a big save in qualification as well. So, I think they'll be all pretty good at it. I think they'll be all very well versed in who's taking penalties. And you never know what Popper's ideas are. Maybe statistically, one's a better penalty saver than the other. We've seen it in the past with the Socceroos when we qualified for 2022 against Peru. You know, went to penalty shootout and Graham Arnold, you know, changed Matty Ryan for Andrew Redmayne and he makes two saves and we qualify for the World Cup.
And Redmayne makes the save. It's a save that means the world to Australia. It's a save that means the World Cup for Australia.
You never know with Popper. Popper, the attention to detail is really, really precise. He'll have all that information, whether he enacts upon that information, because sometimes I think also it's rhythm. It's being in the game, being in the moment. So there's a lot of different things to take into consideration. I'm a believer that the guy that's playing, unless the stats are really, really telling, unless it's like really obvious that someone is just an exceptional penalty taker, I'm a believer that the person who's in the moment, in the rhythm, is the one that should continue.
Let's look ahead to this Socceroos side to take on this Egyptian side. We've slice and diced selection conversations throughout this tournament. I feel like we've gained information and data points along the way. How would you be setting up the 11 to take down Egypt?
You know what? I wouldn't be surprised if, obviously, Patrick Beech will start, I believe. I believe the same back three who played, Chakati, Suter and Harrington, I believe will start. Jordi Bos on the right-hand side, I think that will stay the same, as is Beech on the left-hand side. I don't think that will change. The big question marks are on that front three, two advanced midfielders and the number nine, who are going to fill those positions. You're probably well aware of what I would probably say. You know, I believe Aaron Kunda should be on the left side of that. I think either Mo Touré or Yankee up front. We need someone to have an outlet. I think, I'll say it again, Aaron Kunda's wasted in that position. Me personally, we're not getting the best out of him in that position. He does a great job, works his absolute socks off like he did against Paraguay. And one could easily turn around and go, look, job done, because we got the result we needed. But this is more about just getting a draw. This is more now about trying to get goals and try and win the game. Ideally, you want to win the game in normal time. You don't want to go to extra time. You don't want to go to penalties, because anything can happen. And the big question for me then is, if he does then put Aaron Kunda out on the left and he puts one of the big strikers up front, who does he leave out? Is it Connor Metcalf or Christian Volpato? I think there's valid arguments for either. I really do. I think Connor Metcalf has been excellent the whole tournament. He's been really, really important for the Socceroos. I think Christian Volpato did really well when he came on against the US. I thought he did well against Paraguay. Final third, turnovers was probably a little bit higher than it should have been. Then the little elements of that he can learn from in that game. And delivering the box was something in set plays that we definitely need to hone in on, need to get a lot better on, because we didn't do those well against Paraguay. I think that can be game changers for us. That service, delivering the box, needs to be better. Christian Volpato showed, starting from the start, he can be really, really energetic, really, really important, can create chances, can really cause problems down the right-hand side. But I also think a Christian Volpato coming on with half an hour, 40 minutes to go, whatever it is, can change the game for us. So there's different ways of looking at it.
I don't know if you saw, but in the aftermath of the draw with Paraguay, Tony Popovich was asked about the six selections that he made, or six changes that he made to the starting lineup. And selection's been such a talking point throughout this tournament, because we got shocks in the first game. We got shocks again for United States. We got shocks again for Paraguay. And he didn't appreciate the question.
For the first game, you would have told me you were surprised with the selection. And if we didn't get the result, you'd be the first one saying, why did I select them? Then we leave a couple out the second game. Then you ask, why are those two not selected? And now we make six changes. And now you ask me again, why are those six in and the other ones out? That will continue, because that's the analysis that we have back home.
Were you surprised to see that level of bristle from the manager in the immediate aftermath of that outcome against Paraguay?
A little bit. And maybe that tells you that They've seen the noise, they've seen the comments. It's maybe annoyed them a little bit. But look, that's part of management. That's part of being in a World Cup. That's part of, you have a really good performance against Turkey. Then the performance against the US, particularly in the first 45 minutes, was nowhere near as good. And the direct correlation is the substitutions. You've made changes to your team. Why do you change a team that has such great momentum and did really well in the first game? They're all valid questions to ask. It doesn't mean that people are happy when you ask those questions, but there's also an element of, right, okay, well, can you explain why that? And obviously, clearly, he doesn't want to explain it. And that's fine. You know, he's well entitled, well within his rights to decide not to explain it. The thing is, as a manager and at a World Cup, and, you know, we've got 14 million people that have watched the Socceroos play so far at this World Cup, which is phenomenal. There comes with that more scrutiny, more under the microscope, more when things don't go quite to plan, when you've made changes. I think any manager will be questioned about changes that are made when results don't turn out in favour, when you lose a little bit of rhythm and a little bit of momentum, which we did against the US. Yes, the second half performance was better. It was better because we actually performed better, but it was also because the US dropped off and were more in containment mode and trying to hit us on the counter. So, you know, there's valid arguments for both sides. And also what was telling of that interview was a post-match was he talked about the fact that he picks teams based on the opponents. He will continue to make changes.
What I will say is that every player is important. No one is entitled to the shirt, and each game is different, and different circumstances and different situations for each game at a different time. And for this game, this is a team I believe needed to play. That's it, and I'll always back my decision.
He's very adamant and I thought that was very telling to say that, well, don't expect necessarily the same team that's going to play, that played against Paraguay, to play against Egypt, because it's game by game, team by team. That's how he picks his teams.
It's interesting, you touched on something there, and it's the level of engagement with the Socceroos team right now. And as someone who covers sort of all sports, I'm not football specific, it strikes me as a really good opportunity to sell your story, to tell your story. And I have been surprised that Nestor Iancunda, Mo Touré, are two players who haven't done press conferences where all of the traveling press pack can get access to them. They've done a little bit of mix zone after the games, but those are short bursts. Like, you're talking three or four questions with reporters about the game that's just happened. Am I reading too much into it? Like, is it notable the fact that those guys aren't being made available to media?
Yeah. I mean, more so for people who are there, right? So, and also from the outside world, I suppose, because you're kind of going, well, actually, I want to hear more from Iancunda. I want to hear more from Motura. I want to hear from these guys that I'm not hearing much of. And I understand it, right? I totally get it, because as fans, as public, you want to hear about these guys and their stories and how the World Cup is and how it's impacting them and how they're feeling and how their confidence, all those sorts of things is absolutely normal. But we've also seen it, like, at various times. I mean, the World Cup in 2006 was very different in terms of every 3 days, everyone was put forward. You were on a rota. Basically, 6-7 players went each time to the press. Of those, two players or so would be doing the bigger interviews and the rest would do mix zones. So basically, as a player, every 3 days you were up, you were doing the press. We saw it particularly in 2022. I was in Qatar, and Graham Arnold was very open with the press. He was very encouraging. When I was there, and they would put a player in for a press conference every single day, with all the media allowed to ask them all questions. They would bring four or five players out to see the press every day, and every one of the press would get 3-4 minutes with each of those players. It's just different styles and different management. We saw it in the Matildas. You know, look at the Matildas during the World Cup. Very little exposure from the vast majority of the squad. Only select numbers of players were put forward. Managers have different opinions. Players also, if you give players an option, a lot of players would shun from it. You know, a lot of players are like, no, I don't want to do it. But that's where you kind of, like, I'm a firm believer as well. I'm a firm believer that we should be a little bit more open. I think we should be more engaging. We have a unique opportunity at a World Cup to embrace, to engage, to try and bigger the game, better the game, get more people on board, in particular back home in Australia. That's who I think, like, Australian media, that's where we should be honing in on and getting everyone on board. And I think back to 2022, it actually worked to the Socceroos' advantage, because everyone was vested in it. Everyone was on board. All the media was all about the positivity of everything. You know, it creates this incredible amount of wave of positivity and momentum that the players are engaging, the players are open, the coaches have been open. You know, and look, Pop is different, and people have different ideas and different opinions, and he's well within his right to do that.
And I guess he'd probably make the argument that ultimately he's there to try and progress him as far as possible, and that's working for them right now, whatever he's doing.
That is also correct, but there's also an element of responsibility, right, to engage, to fulfill media obligations and all that sort of stuff, right? And I think you can look at it a couple of ways. You can be closed shop and be as secretive and everything else, and which you can still do with players still engaging with the media, because they're just conversations that you have with people and go, look, these are the things we don't want to talk about. Anything else you can talk about, but these are the key things we're not talking about. And you can be more controlling about it, but there's also an opportunity for these guys, a lot of these guys, who are people that are only starting to find out about them. People are only starting to know who these people are. It's important for football in Australia for us to showcase these players, to enhancely improve upon their name, their presence in the game, because it's a relatively unknown Socceroos side, certainly to the general public, not football fans, because football fans in Australia all know who they are, but the wider public. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to embrace at all levels, at all business world, political world, everything, for people to, these players to become household names. We want household names in football.
Globally, household name, Mo Salah, hamstring injury, brought himself off, Egyptian star, seems talismanic for them. Last I checked, he hadn't trained for Egypt this week. Would you expect him to play, to start, or is it more going to be like a off-the-bench scenario?
If he has any chance of feeling like he can play for whatever minutes it is, I'm sure he'll be there. But I believe it's a strained hamstring. I believe that's what the report, the public release that was done by the Egyptian FA. That's not to say that he's not fit. Not that he's not fit. He's clearly not fit just yet, but that's not to say that he's not doing a lot of work behind closed doors. I'm sure he is. What type of work? That's the question, right? So is he doing recovery work? Is he doing stuff that he's trying to help and hope that it repairs as quickly as possible? Or is he doing actually physical work that is enabling him to get fit? We won't know until the game. It's sad for, if he's not able to play, it's sad for Mo, it's sad for Egypt, it's sad for football, because he's a phenomenal player. But I'm not going to lie, I'm going to be happy if he's not playing, because he's such a good player, right? And I think that's quite normal, right? You know, I love the guy, I think the guy's a phenomenal footballer. You know, he's one of the greats of the game. But for this game, I'm happy if he's not playing, because that's how good he is.
He's certainly a heck of a talent. I dare say the back three would be pleased to see him not playing as well, potentially. Just a quick one as we wrap up. I'm sure you saw France this morning, Kylian Mbappe. Oh, my goodness. Like, this team, they are just as smooth as water once they get going.
Elise. Oh, sweet, sweet. Mbappe is so sweet. This football is from the heavens. Who on earth stops the French playing like this?
They've got to be the team to beat right now, don't they?
I think so, yeah. I definitely think they're the favourite. I said it pre-tournament, and my big question mark was, is it too long for Didier Deschamps to be managing the national team? I thought the Euros was disappointing from France. They made it to the semi-final, but they kind of stuttered along and they didn't play great football. And you kind of look at these players and you're thinking, well, you've got to get more out of these group of players, back then even. So obviously there's been a lot of changes. What I have been impressed with is the relationship. Bakola, Mbappe, Elise, Dembele. Mbappe openly has admitted, and I think probably the best thing that's ever happened to him, is Luis Enrique criticised him about his lack of work ethic and about his lack of contribution off the ball, out of possession. And to his credit, he's taken it on board, right? And I mean, whether he's annoyed by it or not, I'm sure he was, but he's taken it on board, and his involvement and his contributions have been phenomenal. He looks like a rejuvenated player, right? What I do like about this team is those combinations, the relationships, the patterns of play. For me, I would have to say my favourite player in world football right now is Michael Olise, and has been for probably a good 12 months now. I just love watching him play. Every time he plays, he's just sensational. I mean, he almost scored probably one of the greatest goals at a World Cup today. Unfortunately, hit the post and came back out. There's so much to like about this France team right now.
We are getting to the pointy end of this tournament. So much more to go, though. I can't believe we've got such a slate of matches coming away in the next week. Mark Schwarzer, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Headlines coming into the tournament. The conversation around Kylian Mbappe was whether a relatively grim season with Real Madrid was a kind of portent for the World Cup. That looks laughable right now. Another two goals from the French captain as they eased past Sweden 3-0. He has six for the tournament. That's equal with Lionel Messi, who has played one fewer game. Sitting one back with five goals is Erling Haaland, who scored the winner for Norway as they knocked Cote d'Ivoire out of the tournament with a 2-1 win. Their manager, Ståle Solbakken, was asked if he'd trade the Man City striker for anyone else in the tournament.
To score five goals in the World Cup in three games for a little country like Norway, that's... I don't think even he had thought that he could do that before. So all the credit to him, and I would never swap him for anyone because he's the greatest goal scorer in the world football today.
They next play Brazil. Isn't that going to be a contrast of styles? Carlo Ancelotti's side against a Haaland spearheaded Norway. And the Norwegian fans rowing an imaginary boat has been one of the cooler things from this tournament. Here's the manager on that.
Every woman and man from 100 years old to 2 years old is rowing in Norway now. And when we arrive in airports around the States, they are rowing there as well. So that's not my biggest concerns, but I think it's fun and I think it's great for togetherness.
The final game of the day was between Mexico and Ecuador. It was delayed due to wild weather when they eventually got away. You know what was wild? The crowd. Mexican fans in dreamland as their side knocked over their South American opponents 2-0 and moved into a likely round of 16 clash with England. To understand just how big this tournament is in Mexico, in case you couldn't tell, and it's pretty evident, scroll back in our feed and listen to our interview with Jenny Chu, former Mexican national representative. She does a great job of underlining and underscoring just how big this World Cup is to a nation that is football obsessed. I'm Patrick Stack. This was ABC Sport Daily World Cup special produced by Poppy Penny. Thanks to SBS, Fox Sports, the Socceroos and Paramount Plus for the extra audio used in this episode.